Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith. We're here to reconnect the eternal with the everyday and help you make those connections between the headline news and the mind of Christ that will equip you to enter into the conversations of the day with grace and truth. And today's headline news is nothing short of salacious. And so I might warn you in advance that the conversations that we're going to be having during the show today are going to include words and conversations that might not be appropriate for the littlest of ears. And so you might consider this something that you download via podcast from My Faith Radio if conversations about Stormy Daniels or Nashville's Mayor Megan Berry might include information you're not prepared to have a conversation with your children about. So we're going to talk about those news items here in our opening segment. And I'm going to have those conversations with Neil Stavem. Neil, hey, welcome back to your own show.
Yes, thank you. Well, Carmen, love the opportunity to connect with you and looking forward to good days ahead as we continue to address important issues. And I was thinking, you know, as you just, you know, mentioned the words of what Merriam-Webster, just the dictionary, they added, what, 850 new words this year. And thinking, you know, one of the words that you know, yesterday and Monday, we've talked about some new words that maybe some old words we need to revisit. Maybe there's an old word we had to revisit, and that's the word fidelity. Because, as you mentioned, Stormy Daniels, and you know, maybe people don't know much about her, but they know the story. And Nashville's mayor. I mean, both of those stories are areas where fidelity should come into play.
Well, you're exactly right, Neil, and I think that as Christians, we need to be thinking about the words that we want to use in the conversations of the day. So we want to be careful when we start talking about subjects like this, in part because we don't want to fall into gossip. Like, that's not the goal of having these conversations. The goal of having these conversations is to bear authentic witness to the truth of who God is, to his expectations of us as his people in the culture. And then to be people who speak the truth into the lives of others when they see and experience the brokenness in the culture, and they begin to ask themselves, hey, I didn't actually think that, you know, sex outside of marriage was any real big deal. And yet these two headline news stories of the day are about adultery. These are stories about adultery, and they are stories that are leading the news because the figures involved are politicians, are people who we are entrusting with certain roles and responsibilities. And so in breaking their marriage vows, we begin to ask the question, or allegedly breaking their marriage vows, we begin to ask the question, is this a person that we should trust? Is this a person who should be entrusted with public funds? Is this a person who should be, you know, shepherding a city or shepherding a country? And so that's actually why we would wander around in this kind of subject matter, in part because it literally is the headline news of the day. It is the thing that the commentators on the news are going to be talking about. And so we want to equip our listeners to be prepared for these conversations. But I think that from the Christian worldview and from a Christian perspective, the words that we want to introduce here are words like fidelity. The questions that we want to ask are questions about if a person is unable to keep the primary promise or the primary vow to the other person in the world who they stood before God and made a promise to, then what does it say about this individual's trustworthiness? And so I think that for Christians, those are some of the conversations or some of the soil that we want to till for conversation today.
Is it, you know, a conversation that had happened, you know, maybe what, 15, 20 years ago? So, well, you know, someone's personal life doesn't matter in their public life. I mean, haven't we, when people say, well, we've kind of gone beyond that, we don't, you know, we're not focusing on that anymore in terms of politics. Is that still an issue that we need to raise and address?
So that is an excellent observation, because from the news viewpoint and from the viewpoint of politics, neither one of these stories is about adultery. Both of these stories is about money and contractual agreements and whether or not people were doing what they should not have been doing when they were on the job and should have been doing something else. And so in the case of the allegations of Stormy Daniels, which is a stage name of an individual whose given name is Christine something, this person has a brand, I believe, that she is seeking to promote. And this is an opportunity to promote her brand, regardless of whatever else it is. This is about money, and this is about a contract, and this isn't about an exchange of money. And this is about how much money you can make with a salacious story today. And so I think that says a lot about our culture, and it says a lot about the appetite in our culture for salacious news. And so I think that particularly in the story related to the allegations made against the president by this individual, one of the things we must keep in mind here is our First Lady and their son, right? Because every time these kinds of stories are told, there's a marriage and there's a family that is being wounded. And there is a dad who has to talk to his son. And so, you know, when we are tempted at any point to gossip or laugh or make light of infidelity, let us be very mindful of how precious marriage is in God's sight, why he gives it to us as something that reflects an eternal reality of the relationship between his son, Jesus Christ, and the bride of the church. We don't have marriage as, you know, God copies marriage in, you know, and he's like, oh, marriage seems like a really good idea. Let's use marriage as, you know, these people figured out this whole marriage thing. So let's use what they've come up with and let's turn that into, you know, something that we talk about in the Bible and something that, you know, I tell them is going to be true eternally in terms of their relationship with Jesus. No, it's quite the reverse of that. God has a sanctified relationship with humanity through his son, Jesus Christ. And what he gives us as a vision, as an understanding, as a mystery that points to that is marriage. And so anytime marriage is held in dishonor, falls into disrepute, is misunderstood, is even redefined by a culture, we're messing around with what God has given to us as a gift that is intended to be good and holy and sacred and undefiled. And so I think that Christians need to be on the forefront of redeeming fidelity, chastity, marriage, the sacredness of sex, the intimacy of one husband and one wife. And yes, we recognize we live in a fallen and broken reality where lots of marriages are broken against, you know, against all of the wreckage that sin causes in our lives. But that still doesn't make it right. And we can't justify it.
Earlier today, listening to James McDonald walk in the Word, and made this statement about, you know, some people dabble in sin and others walk right in. And I think, you know, we need to, stories like this, while they're, you know, the news is salacious, it does remind us that we need to reevaluate and guard our hearts, right, and make sure that we have the guardrails set up, because we are not above the temptation.
No, that's exactly right. So guardrails, I think that's a really good word. I guess I would ask every listener today, you know, have you set up the guardrails in your own life in such a way that you know you're going to be, you know, staying in a place that's really safe? Guardrails don't exist to limit our freedom. Guardrails exist to keep us from literally going over the edge. And so, you know, when we talk about guardrails in the spiritual life, we're talking about the scriptures, we're talking about Christian accountability, we're talking about being in relationship, significant enough relationship with other Christians that they can ask us the hard questions, and we will be honest and vulnerable about our temptations, our proclivity to things like pornography, the you know, any relationships that are even beginning to tiptoe toward being inappropriate. We've got to have brothers and sisters in Christ with whom we are in very significant relationship and community who can say, hey, I'm going to be the guardrail on this one, right? I'm actually going to be the person who's going to tell you that smells fishy. That looks fishy. Don't go there because it's endangering you. It's endangering your relationship with your spouse, and it's endangering your family. Don't do this. And it's certainly compromising your witness to Jesus Christ. And so all of the ways in which, you know, the media and everybody else has, you know, maligned Mike Pence for, you know, having as one of his guardrails that he never spends time alone with a woman other than his wife. You know, the world can make all the fun of that that the world wants to make. But in reality, that's a guardrail that protects not only Mike Pence's heart, but his marriage and therefore his public witness as a Christian. And so I just encourage people to think about the guardrails that you've set up and consider strengthening those by actually spending time in the Word and time in accountable relationships with other Christians.
And that's particularly important as it comes to helping the next generation navigate the culture in which we live, because the word inappropriate is hardly known, I would say. So coming up in the moments ahead, Carmen's going to enter into a conversation with John Stonestreet. You hear John regularly on the daily cultural commentary called Breakpoint. He's president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview and co-host of Breakpoint, and he's authored a wonderful book called A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. Honored to have John Stonestreet on with us coming up in just a moment here on Connecting Faith with Carmen LaBurge. Listening to Connecting Faith with host Carmen LaBurge. I'm Neil Statham, just sitting in and ready for a great conversation. Carmen, we always love having a thoughtful of friends and familiar voices on Faith Radio, and that's the case for today.
Yeah, that's right. John Stonestreet, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, the co-host of Breakpoint, a voice heard every day here on Faith Radio. Breakpoint is the daily cultural commentary founded by the late Chuck Colson. John holds degrees from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School and Bryan College, and he and his family live in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And he's engaged in all kinds of great worldview equipping ministries like Summit. And John, thank you so much for joining us today and for your ministry.
Hey, thanks so much. It's always good to talk to you, Carmen. Thank you.
So I'm going to jump right in to some headline news of the day and get us talking about some of the cultural conversations, because, first of all, you're tremendously adept at this, and this is what we're trying to equip people to do. You know, how do we bring the mind of Christ to bear on the actual headlines of the day? So let's see. Mike Huckabee, former Baptist pastor, former Arkansas governor, name known to everybody. You got to think that you'd want to have his name on something if you were trying to raise a bunch of money, which is my guess why the Country Music Association Foundation thought he would be a good addition to their fundraising board. But a lot of people responded to that announcement with such hostility, saying that his Christian values were in conflict with the country music genre. Can you just help us understand sort of where we've arrived at in our day when a person who... You know, the only thing somebody can hold against him is his maybe view of marriage. And suddenly that means he can't help raise money.
Well, I mean, this is why it's essential to understand that worldviews don't peacefully coexist most often. I mean, I guess it's sometimes they do, but we have a liberalism in America that's increasingly become illiberal, a tolerance that is becoming more and more intolerant, or at least a call for tolerance that really is becoming more and more intolerant. And the example of this, and this is the idea that's driving this particular story, like so many other stories, whether we're talking about Jack Phillips, the baker in Denver, or Baron L. Sutzman, the florist in Washington, or we're talking about, you know, the parents in Ohio who just had their daughter taken away by a judge, is this kind of new sexual orthodoxy. It's a subset of this liberalism, which says that liberalism truly is just freedom, not only for flourishing in life, but it's from any restraint whatsoever, even the restraints of nature itself. And to deny that is to deny someone's autonomy, someone's freedom, and therefore to deny someone's humanity. So there's a whole lot of ideas latent in all that stuff that I just said. But Huckabee, because he agrees with, you know, people of faith and what they've said about sexuality and marriage since, you know, the beginning of time until yesterday, now is in the category of a racist or a bigot And we see the same sort of language. We saw it in Justice Kennedy's language in the Obergefell decision, which mandated same-sex marriage. We saw it in the recent – the judge's decision to take a 17-year-old away from her parents who wouldn't go along with her gender transitioning. You know, the same sort of language. And we see it in the language of against Mike Huckabee. And, you know, there's also, too, you know, complicating that is, you know, Mike Huckabee has been a supporter of Donald Trump, and supporters of Donald Trump have no place in the public square in you know, areas of media or entertainment or things like that. So you have, you know, again, this is a dominant worldview, a vision of reality that is basically trying to intimidate and run out any sort of competitors. That's the world in which we live right now, like it or not.
Okay, so when you say that different worldviews cannot coexist, I obviously respond to that by saying, hey, I thought pluralism was a good thing, and not only a good thing from the viewpoint of liberals, but, you know, a good thing from the viewpoint of conservatives or Christians when we're in the minority, right? Anybody in the minority wants pluralism to flourish because pluralism allows for minority opinions. So when Christianity was maybe the majority opinion, maybe pluralism was looked at as a bad thing. But pluralism is now looked at as a good thing in terms of, hey, shouldn't there be space in the conversation for everybody and every viewpoint? So why is it then that there's not room in the conversation in a pluralistic culture? Why is there no room for the Christian worldview?
Well, when I say worldviews can't coexist, I don't necessarily mean that people who champion those worldviews can't coexist. And that's been the distinction that has long created a pluralistic context, right? That you know, this is what we typically mean by tolerance. I disagree with you, but I'm going to respect your right to have an opinion. I'm going to respect you as a human being. And you know, really that distinction between those two things. But that's increasingly gone away. Particularly because of the assumptions of the new sexual revolution, you know, which is to question someone's beliefs is to question their integrity, their autonomy, their human dignity, and their human value. And so there's two lessons to be learned here. I mean, number one is that Christians, you know, can do those revolutionary things that we find in Proverbs that don't sound really revolutionary, but in our culture they are. Like, for example, a soft answer turns away wrath. In a place where every disagreement becomes an argument, becomes a fight, becomes a no-holds-barred, you know, survivor wins all sort of situation, we can model and we have to model a better way. But we also need to understand that when we're talking about disagreements, we're not just talking about small-level disagreements. The disagreement between proponents of the sexual revolution and Christians are disagreements about the most fundamental questions of life, what we call the ultimate questions. You know, basically, is there a creator and are we created? Are we self-determined or are we identified because of how the creator made us? And are there moral norms? I mean, these aren't just small disagreements about things. I mean, these are even more fundamental than, you know, questions about the nature of marriage or, you know, sex or things like that. I mean, we're talking about disagreements about the nature of reality itself. So we need to understand that the disagreements are at that level. And then we also have to argue, we have to make our case, we have to have clarity, but we need to do it as Jesus taught us to do it, which is with a belief that every person that we engage with is made in the image of God, worthy of dignity and respect, even if they're not necessarily treating us that way.
Friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. That familiar voice you hear is John Stonestreet. He is the host of Breakpoint, which is where you hear him every day. Quickly talking about these subjects, but you can always go to Breakpoint's website and get further equipping. And then, John, you guys actually have something that I totally love, which is called the Wilberforce Weekend, and that's coming up. Why don't you tell people about that so that they can be getting the information about that as well?
Well, you know, Chuck Colson bequeathed us. I like that word. You like that word, bequeathed?
I love it.
Bequeathed us a vision of cultural engagement, and he had some heroes. You know, first of all, William Wilberforce, that was first among his heroes. Here is a guy deeply a man of faith, but also a man that understood he had been called to the public square. So what does it look like for Christians to be called in the public square? in that tradition of Wilberforce. He established this kind of annual conference called the Wilberforce Weekend, and it's growing. We had 700 people that gather who are interested in thinking more deeply about Christian worldview, but also becoming an agent of reconciliation, restoration, and hope. This year, we're going to talk, by the way, about calling, about the fact that God has created us, all human beings, and He has restored us in Jesus Christ to be people who care about culture, who are able to confront culture, and also able to create culture. And a fantastic lineup: Eric Metaxas, the musician Andrew Peterson, the incomparable Johnny Erickson Tata, just a wonderful lineup of folks who are going to help us think about those three aspects of our engagement with culture: to confront culture, to create culture, and to care about culture. It's May 18th through the 20th in Washington, D.C., wilberforceweekend.org. We're filling up fast. We've got a few spaces left, but we are filling up fast. But we'd love for Christians who are really interested in going deeper and what it means to engage the culture. That's what the Wilberforce Weekend has always been about.
Well, and one of the things I love about this particular weekend is it's not just sitting and soaking in content from, you know, the person who's speaking up front. There really is engagement around
right.
these conversational tables. And you guys have really designed this in such a way that that folks can interact with the material and actually become genuinely equipped, not just informed. So I really appreciate that. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to circle back around to a couple of things that you said and ask you to define some terms, because I think that when we have these conversations, and particularly if this is the arena that we roam around in a lot, then sometimes we use words that not everybody who's listening may be quite as familiar with, or maybe using in the same way that we're using them. So talk with us about autonomy, and then talk with us about how, from a Christian worldview, we're dependent creatures. We're not autonomous.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, in fact, I'm so glad you went here, Carmen, because really the battle for our hearts and minds when it comes to culture is always the battle over the definition of words. So we oftentimes use words like freedom and dignity. Freedom is one, though, that, you know, historically has meant freedom for flourishing, freedom for life, freedom for, you know, living according to the way that God's created us to live. But it's become, in our culture, freedom from any restraints. And that's really the idea of autonomy. The word autonomy is auto, self, nomos, law, self-law, as if we're a complete law to ourselves, as if we're self-determined, and so on. And really, our visions of sexuality in our culture that have come out of the sexual revolution have driven this idea that our dignity is our autonomy. So if there's any restraints on our life whatsoever, you know, from the church, from law, from morality, from kind of the old way, tradition, old ways of doing things, that we're not really dignified because somebody else is calling the shots. That's taken on a whole new form with the LGBT movement, because now it's freedom from nature itself. You know, I was born, you know, this particular with these particular, body parts, but I want to be free from that. So there's a level of autonomy now that's not just from social restraints or institutions or, you know, rules or laws, but actually nature itself. And and that really, if you go deep, it's like us versus the creator. Did the creator determine us, or are we self-determined?
Hey, John, we're going to continue this conversation right after the break. Friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm talking with John Stonestreet. We will continue our conversation in just a moment.
You're listening to Connecting Faith with Carmen LeBurge. I'm Neil Stavem, just sitting in, taking notes. I hope you are as well. Oh, great conversation with the gifted teachers, speakers. Who better than Carmen LeBurge to be talking with John Stonestreet today? And let's get back to it.
Hey, thanks, Neil. All right, John. I told you before the break, we're just gonna head into some really deep water here. So conversations in our culture related to sexuality and sexual expression often center around a conversation related to consent. And I was disturbed to read this week about a new app that, like, apparently people in the hookup culture are using to give their immediate legal consent to things that they ought not be consenting to. But the real troubling story that I want us to talk about is this the story out of France, which has been covered by every news agency. And I'm really kind of surprised by the way it's being covered, as if, of course, France should be setting an age of consent. And of course, 15 is a just fine age to set that at. Can we talk about the concept of consent and age of consent and why 15 might be way too young?
You know, well, look, we can talk about the wisdom of, you know, giving, you know, young people with still developing brains. I mean, we don't let them drink. We don't want them to own guns until they're 21. We don't want them to do anything. But let's basically assume that they're going to make sexual choices and affirm those sexual choices as long as they give their consent. Here's the problem, Carmen. We are a culture that treats sexuality as if it's completely built on autonomy. And when you do that, you divorce sexuality from any sense of its created intent. Now, you know, you asked about autonomy in the last one. Here's the big failure of autonomy. I mean, think about if I gave you a compass and I sent you out to hike through the wilderness of, you know, Minneapolis or something like that. But the compass always points at you, like you're the center of reality. Well, you'd always be lost. Everyone knows that for a compass to work, it's got to point to something fixed outside of ourselves. Well, the whole concept of autonomy is that there's nothing outside of ourselves. There's no moral law. There's no creator. There's nothing to define where we're at or where we're going. That's the problem with sexuality right now, is that when autonomy has become the thing that is the only kind of remaining vision of sexual propriety, then consent's all you have. As long as I say yes, it's okay, as if I'm a law unto myself, as if I can actually make those decisions. That's why we're in such a weird place and confusing and contradictory place. I mean, we spent last year, 2 weeks, celebrating the life of the greatest exploiter of women in our lifetime, Hugh Hefner, when he passed away. And then 2 weeks later, we threw Harvey Weinstein under the bus for sexually exploiting women. You know, put that together. You know, we have a culture that makes movies about the sexual exploitation between a man and a boy, and in the last Oscars, it was nominated for the Best Picture. And then we talk about how awful it is about LGBT rights and about sexual exploitation and so on. And so the only thing left, because there's nothing outside of us to govern our sexuality, is consent. And now, because consent and autonomy are the highest values, then where do you set that? It becomes this arbitrary line, and France apparently thinks that it's going to be a good idea, to lower that, you know, more and more in the name of dignity, in the name of tolerance, in the name of diversity, in the name of all of these concepts that really have no meaning if there's no moral norms outside of our own lives, our own hearts, our own choices.
Well, and since I totally expect that most people are not going to read these stories, these news reports, here's what – I mean, it's more disturbing than just that they think 15. 15 was actually the higher age that was debated. 13 was the lower age that was debated. And the reason they're even having this debate is because in their codified law right now, unless something can be – proven to have been coercive or violent, there is nothing that qualifies as, you know, sexual abuse or rape of a minor, because there is no age of consent set by law. And so if they can't prove in a court of law that these 11-year-olds who have been victimized, if they can't prove that that was coerced or done against their will, then these men who have perpetrated these crimes against children aren't held accountable. And so this is literally how upside down, inside out, backwards and perverted this story is. They are setting an age of consent at 15 in order that everyone, I mean, this is the quote from the article, in order that there will be a collective awareness of what is legal and illegal in terms of sex with children. I mean, I like read it and I'm like, I'm just kind of horrified at this, where we have arrived. And you and I both know that sort of all of these conversations started in France, like, right? It's really the French who are responsible for these
philosophies.
Yeah, we
can blame a lot on the French, can't we? Yeah.
Yeah, I know. And so you're actually the person who taught me that. So give people a little warm up to that, and then talk about the responsibility that we have for kids.
Yeah, well, listen, every stage of the sexual revolution has victimized children. We say around the Colson Center, many people know the phrase, ideas have consequences. That's Richard Weaver's famous idea, that ideas really matter. And the ideas about sexuality that have long been embraced have created this current, and we're downstream from it. But we always add in bad ideas have victims, because we want people not to think about ideas as these disembodied concepts that are debated in ivory towers or in, you know, news magazines or whatever, but that they actually have feet and they walk out into the real world. And the ideas of the sexual revolution are there. Now, let me say a couple things. First is this. How broken is it that we are having conversations now about how to limit the damage to especially children because of these ideas of autonomy and freedom? In other words, there's no mention in any of these articles what sex is for, what good sex is supposed to bring. You know, in other words, no idea of kind of flourishing or life or anything like that. The only conversation we're having is how do we mitigate the damage? How do we lessen the damage so that we can all, you know, kind of be on the same page when something inevitably goes wrong? This is why Christians have so much to offer the world, because we have a vision not just what, you know, where these moral boundaries should be, but we have a vision of what sex is actually for, why God created it, why he gave it to us, the role that it plays in society, the connection that it has to marital institutions. And when it's lived out, we can actually lead to the flourishing of children. We know from every statistic that children do better in a home with married mom and a dad, where it's a stable relationship. I mean, that's like, you know, the evidence is so overwhelming to that. It's actually part of the reality itself, like gravity is. But we have a culture that's long denied these moral norms. And so now we mitigate these challenges. The responsibility to children is a responsibility to the future of society. And yet all these ideas about sexuality that have been part of this devolution of our society, starting with, you know, for example, that marriage doesn't necessarily need to be for life. I mean, think about what we said back then about no-fault divorce. The kids will be okay. As if we knew, which we didn't, and it turns out that we were exactly wrong. We're doing the same thing when it comes to same-sex parenting. You know, kids don't need a mom and a dad. They just need loving parents. When all the research tells us that biological mom and dad are the best situation for children, and that men and women bring different things to the lives of their children. Or as Ryan Anderson says, there's no such thing as parenting. There's just mothering and fathering, because those are such distinct different things. But we're saying the same thing. Oh, the kids will be fine. Well, we said it before. We're saying it again. And now France is saying it like this, trying to – kids clearly haven't been fine, but how do we set appropriate boundaries without violating this new kind of moral imperative of autonomy that we've basically made up out of thin air in order to have our freedom from any restraint? And this is what we mean when we say ideas have consequences, bad ideas have victims. When it comes to sex, children are always the victim or the primary victim of these bad ideas.
Mm. All right, friends, my conversation partner is John Stonestreet. You can find him at breakpoint.org. You refer to lots of thinkers in this area. Do you have somebody who,
right,
you know, who you're paying attention to today, who you're like, hey, that's a person sort of on the Christian worldview scene or in one of these particular areas that you're particularly listening to today?
Well, you know, there's a number of them, honestly. I'm just a conglomerate of really good thinkers, so I don't make up anything new. And you can find that in the book, A Practical Guide to Culture. We're pointing over here for this resource or there for that resource, you know, for parents and mentors. But I'll tell you two people in particular that are writing with clarity. One that's writing with kind of public clarity, in other words, not doing theology, but doing philosophy and legal work, is Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation. He's a young voice. He wrote his book on marriage before he was married, which was kind of ironic. But his book on, you know, the definition of marriage has recently tackled the transgender topic. What I like about that is that he doesn't get rattled. He thinks the truth wins out in the end, and he's able to articulate that. Sometimes you need a translator because he's really, really smart. And so we've tried to bring that to bear as much as we can. I think Ryan's a voice worth listening to. Another is Mark Regnerus. Mark is down at the University of Texas at Austin. Almost had his career ended because he dared go against the orthodoxy of heterosexual versus homosexual parenting. But his research, particularly in how the sexual revolution has disrupted the marketplace of men and women finding each other and settling down is really, really important when you talk about the victims of ideas and the social consequences of these new ideas. So I'm a big fan of him as well. And then also Jennifer Roback Morse at the Ruth Institute. That's another voice we should be listening to. She does some really terrific work, particularly on how the sexual revolution has created so many victims. She has a whole thing, are you a victim of the sexual revolution? 9 different categories. And I think most of us would find ourselves in those categories. You know, children of divorce, exploited by somebody else, addicted to pornography. You could just kind of go, abortion, whether a sibling of abortion or something like that. You can just go down the line and say, well, the sexual revolution has been so big and broad in its scope that we need to actually start questioning it because of the casualties that it's created across the cultural landscape.
Hmm. John Stone Street, thank you so much. I'm writing down the names of the people who you're paying attention to because I pay attention to you. So thank you for being a translator in the culture. Thank you for being a person who thinks in public and then who very clearly articulates for the rest of us, what good thinking is on a subject. I particularly appreciate that you continue to remind us that not only do ideas have consequences, but that bad ideas have victims. And we have to be thinking about that, and we have to be considering that as we make decisions and pursue our own ideologies. So, John, thank you so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith. You guys can find him at breakpoint.org. Hey, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll be talking with Tim Muehlhoff about the Me Too movement.
Another segment of Connecting Faith with Carmen LaBurge underway right now. I'm Neil Staven, just sitting in with Carmen and the guests. And as you've heard Carmen say all the way along, that this is about bringing the mind of Christ to bear in the news of the day. That's part of her passion and heart and what we love to see happen here at Faith Radio. And Carmen, really excited to introduce a regular contributor to Connecting Faith, Tim Muehlhoff. Tim serves as a professor of communication at Biola University, teaches a number of classes there. He's written a number of great books. In fact, his latest, A Winsome Persuasion, Christian Influence in a Postmodern World, received the Christianity Today 2018 Book of the Year Award. So, Tim, welcome to Back to Connecting Faith. And, Carmen, say hello to Tim Muehlhoff.
Hey, Tim. Welcome.
Hey, good morning, Carmen. I look forward to continuing our conversations.
Absolutely, and congratulations on your book award. That's not a category that was lacking competitors. So well done.
Well, thank you. And Neil was being a little too complimentary. It got the merit award, which is a really, really polite way of saying it came in second.
Okay. Well, here,
in our
part of the Upper Midwest, coming in second is kind of what we do. So it seemed very very established. So
that's awesome. All right. So Tim, I thought we would dive right in today into a subject matter area that, folks are familiar with in terms of the conversations happening in the culture related to, let's say, the Me Too movement and what that has exposed in every arena of the culture in terms of exposing sexually abusive relationships. And yet at the Oscars, when, this was supposed to be a night when, the women were basically saying, we're all standing up with each other and this isn't going to happen anymore. We're not going to this is no longer going to be the way of Hollywood. And yet we saw two men who have very well-known histories of violence toward women, Kobe Bryant and Gary Oldman, actually win Oscars. So can you just kind of walk around with me in sort of what does that say about where we're at?
Yeah, great observation, Carmen. First, let me say I'm a huge proponent of the hashtag MeToo movement. I think as Christians, when James says true religion in the sight of God is caring for orphans and widows in distress, the context of that is widows had no advocates. A woman had no advocate in New Testament times and was treated very harshly and really had no one to turn to. So I think the hashtag MeToo movement is when there's violence against women, the Christian movement needs to step up and say, listen, we have a long history of being advocates for women and protecting women physically, emotionally, spiritually. So I think, and again, there's excesses of the movement, and we have to have checks and balances, and the movement's going to get played out in clunky ways sometimes. And I think that's where the Oscars was, this weird moment of, like, what do we do in these situations? So here you have James Franco, who won Best Actor at the Golden Globes for The Disaster Artist, and he's not even nominated, which is very rare that he would not even be nominated for Best Actor at the Oscars. And that's because of charges of violence that he, when he was directing certain actresses, they accused him of being inappropriate, and he has vehemently denied it. And then you get Ryan Seacrest, who's allowed to be on the red carpet, even though there's claims of impropriety on his part. And then, you know, what do you do with Casey Affleck, who in 2010 was twice sued for sexual harassment, and he decides not to present? Usually the best actor presents the award for best actress, and he pulled his name out of consideration. And then you get Gary Oldman, who, you know, The Darkest Hour is just a phenomenal movie, and he is unbelievably good. But in a very public 2001 case, he was accused of choking his ex-wife, beating her with a phone in front of the children. And then in a Playboy interview, uses really derogatory language towards women, and particularly Nancy Pelosi, words that I cannot even paraphrase to you and your listeners. So what do we do with that? And then you get Kobe, who, you know, living on the West Coast, very public case in 2003. He was charged with sexual assault, was arrested, but the woman never agreed to testify in public court. So he was not convicted of that. So what do you do with this? How do you make sense of when do you step in, when's, what's appropriate, and what's the next step as men have been allowed to do things in the darkness for way too long?
Hmm. Well, I'll admit to you that I read an article this morning in World Magazine that's a conversation with Rachel Den Hollander and her husband. And in terms of where, I guess, I hope we go, where she has gone, you know, in terms of coming to the place of recognizing the abuse against her and a willingness to step forward and a willingness to create a platform for other women to step forward. And this is in, you know, relationship to the Larry Nassar gymnastics thing. There's, you know, now 256 identified victims, and, you know, and I guess that list continues to grow. Yeah. It's totally heartbreaking, and it's and it rises again to it, or it raises again the question of what's our responsibility to our kids, and then in the church, you know, in the church, how do we begin to get this right? Because we have certainly in the church not been immune from this problem.
Right. Right. Boy, we got to be careful with the messages we're sending, Carmen. And so here's what I think. If I was running the Oscars, which I'm not, here's what I would suggest to the Oscars, or things that are public like this. I think in the aftermath of just the beginning of the hashtag MeToo movement gaining momentum, I think it would have been appropriate for certain people to step aside. Like, I appreciate Casey Affleck saying, you know what, I'm taking my name out of the running, because I don't want it to detract from a woman winning Best Actress. I think that was wise. I think Ryan Seacrest should have stepped aside and said, listen, while this is being debated, while this is being questioned, and again, I again assert my innocence, I'm going to step aside because these are important issues. And I think we send the wrong message to people that, hey, listen, you can have hashtag MeToo movement all you want, but when it comes to Hollywood, when it comes to the Oscars, it doesn't affect us, per se. And so I think it would have been wise for some of these men to simply say, you know, and again, so does Kobe give up his award? Does Gary Oldman give up his award? I think probably not. But I think they come out and support the movement anyway. I think they come out and say, listen, this has gone on way too long. And I just want to say that I support the movement, and I get why people are angry at me winning this award. But, you know, that didn't come up from either of them necessarily. I like what one person wrote an article about this. He said this, Oldman's win is not necessarily a referendum on the Oscars themselves. It is a referendum on the structure of Hollywood, a structure that the Oscars reinforce and a structure that itself birthed the Oscars and how it allows alleged predators to flourish in its shadows. So I think it's time for us to shine a bright light and expose people in the shadows. But let me make one other point, Carmen, that I think Hollywood needs to embrace, and that it's been incredibly hypocritical in light of the hashtag MeToo movement. In other words, 50 Shades of Grey, which in the United States was the top 50 Shades Freed, the third installment in the franchise, it was the top grossing money maker in the United States, you know, pre-Valentine's Day, and in the world did $97 million sales in the first weekend. And I just think we look at that and we say, Hollywood, come on, you cannot objectify women and glorify physical abuse and then want to say, hey, we support the hashtag MeToo movement. I don't think you get to play it both ways.
Well, I think we have a culture that very much likes to play it both ways in many conversations. And I think that what we're then challenged to do as Christians is to be very clear about what the right way is. And recognize that that's particularly narrow in the world's view, and then be prepared to say sex is good and it's godly when it's celebrated in the context of the God-given relationship between the husband and wife, and we want to bear witness to its goodness and its fruitfulness and what it does to produce human flourishing and culture and families. And then we want to say, and there's a darkness to what's going on. In terms of the way sex is being portrayed by Hollywood, and that leads to a culture that very much misunderstands what sex is for and how it ought to be enjoyed instead of used as a weapon. So, hey, Tim, thank you so much for being – yeah, go ahead. We got time.
Oh, absolutely, Carmen. I agree. But here's the problem I have with how Christians do sexuality in the arts is we present such a watered-down view of sexuality that, yeah, we criticize Hollywood – but then we offer a PG version of sexuality that everybody looks at and says, man, that's just not reality. Sexuality is much more complex than the PG handling of it that Christians and Christian authors are forced to have because nobody will support a Christian picture that has a complex view of sexuality.
Excellent observation. All right. Hey, we're glad you are in California. We're glad you're on a college campus. We're glad you're thinking about these things, and we're glad you join us here on Connecting Faith. So thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Carmen.
All right, Neil, it's been a robust day, man.
Wow.
We've covered a lot of subject matter, and some of it has been at least PG.
These are topics that we are addressing and need to address. In fact, I know one of the notes I'd written down was right at the outset of the show. We were talking about, you know, some of the stories of the day, and my question was, you know, how do we make this not gossip? Is it a matter of maybe starting with a question when we want to bring up the conversation? And maybe that's something we can develop here in the days ahead. And speaking of days ahead, looking forward to tomorrow's program, Longing for Motherhood. Tell me a little bit about the guest tomorrow, Chelsea.
Yeah, so get your I'll just tell you in advance, get your Kleenex ready. Chelsea's story, personal story, is incredible. The book is fantastic. And she addresses the reality that as Christian women, we are set up to long for motherhood. But for many of us, having children of our own is just not a part of God's plan. And so we're going to talk about that very sensitive and important issue tomorrow here on Connecting Faith.
It's certainly easy to feel isolated in so many ways in our world, and this is just one other area where the church has an opportunity to stand up and be light and loving with the grace and truth. So Longing for Motherhood, the topic for tomorrow's Connecting Faith with Carmen LaBerge. I wanted to say, if you missed part of today's program, you want to listen to it again because it was you heard Carmen's warning in the beginning, say this is going to be a sensitive conversation. Maybe you want to just listen to it on a podcast. You can find that. We post it on the website, the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. It's myfaithradio.com, and click on Connecting Faith. And Carmen, we're looking forward to great programs ahead. Thank you so much for stepping in and being the new host of the show. We really are enjoying the conversation.
Hey, thanks, Neil. We'll see everybody tomorrow here on Connecting Faith.
Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.